You're listening to an episode from Tales from the First Tee. I'm your host, Rich Easton, telling tales from beautiful Charleston, South Carolina. In this week's episode, I'll talk about the NFL division playoffs. And man, there were four incredible games. Playing golf in cold weather. What do you do if you yank a drive OB and it ends up sitting in the middle of somebody's backyard? How doing business offsite can benefit you if you just know how to handle it. But first, I'll start with a segment I call What Happened on This Day in History. On this day in January in 1957, the company Wham-O rolled out their first line of Frisbees. Now, the idea of Frisbees started in the early 1900s in Saskatchewan, where this group of students played something called tin lid golf. I mean, they virtually threw these tin plates into these holes in the ground. So, I mean, they were just bored shitless, right? But now fast forward 57 years, and this guy, Ed Heidrick, who works for Wham-O, decides to leave the company after he brings this new product to market and develops this Frisbee golf game, which then becomes disc golf. And did you know that disc golf now, according to their industry marketing team, is the fourth fastest growing sport in America, behind pickleball, MMA, and roller derby? And if you're growing slower than roller derby, I'm not sure that's really something to brag about. But obviously, somebody on the marketing team trying to tout this disc golf thought that the fourth fastest sport in America sounds cool and exciting and maybe gets you attracted to try it. You know, numbers are funny. When I founded this category management department at this company, my job was to take information data, translate it into actionable insights, and then give it to our sales and marketing department to talk to customers about. You could do just about anything with numbers, and you don't have to lie. You just have to point out what you want people to see. Saying that disc golf is the fourth fastest growing sport in America should stop right there. When you start introducing things like MMA and roller derby, it kind of takes the wind out of your sails. I mean, if I were promoting disc golf, I would just say something like, it's one of America's fastest growing sports. It's COVID safe, doesn't cost much to play, and the act of throwing things at targets goes deep into mankind's DNA. Playing golf in cold weather. What's the genesis of our need to brag about playing in cold weather? So over the weekend, I'm watching the Green Bay 49ers game. Zero wind chill factor. People in the stands, while mostly embobbed with their favorite libations, still look miserable, particularly in the fourth quarter when their Packers started showing some signs of quitting them. I like the Packers. I like Packer fans, and I like Aaron Rodgers. But if I didn't have to watch another football game in snow, ice, or 0 degrees, I'd be fine with that. I like watching quarterbacks air out the ball. I like to see receivers make miraculous catches. It's really hard to do that when the ball comes at you and it stings and it bounces off your hands in 0 degrees. I mean, to me, cold weather sports should be reserved for skiing, snowboarding, ice fishing, and snowmobiling. So I'm at the range the other day, and it's pretty cold. Not as cold as it had been, but it's still pretty cold. And I overheard this senior golfer talking to a friend of his, and his friend hadn't played with him in a few weeks, and he said, man, you should have played with us yesterday. And the other guy's like, hey, it was like 39, 40 degrees and windy yesterday. And then the original guy's like, yeah, I know. It was hard to hit the ball on the green. It was hard to carry some of the marshes, but it was a test for all of us, despite the fact that we all shot our highest round of the year.
Sheesh, that's crazy.
So it made me think, what drives us as humans to perform in discomfort? Now, I didn't want to interview our local martyr and convalescent, a person I call the Tin Man, so I watched the History Channel to see if there are any nuggets of insights, and there were. So I'm watching this series on the History Channel the other day about the proliferation of our race and the migration from Africa to colder climates. The resiliency of men and women was the most important factor in our survival and proliferation of mankind. Survival rates back then for newborns were far less than 50%. The average lifespan in cold climate was only 30 years old. And that's why sometimes I shake my head when I hear about these diets that resemble how cavemen and early settlers ate. Paleo, keto, loom, and noom. They only lived till they were 30. Yeah, just eat like Tom Brady. We applaud those that can deal with cold climate and survive. What's funny to me is most all of the guys that I know that are down here that maybe play in shorts or that talk about why not play in cold weather, they all relocated from the north. They purposely picked up all their shit and moved it hundreds of miles south to escape the cold. And now some of those same guys are weather shaming people for not wanting to play when it's in the 40s. I consider myself a fair weather golfer. I know why I migrated south. And playing golf in 30 and 40 degrees and hardly wearing any clothes, that's not tough. When I think of tough, I think of Sparta and the Spartans. 300 men had to face hundreds of thousands of Persians and Leonidas. And here's an interesting factoid. They eventually beat the Persian Empire. The Spartans first had to unite with the Greeks, who at that time were their enemies. But the Greeks weren't a threat to the Persians because the Greeks were not fighters by nature. They were artists. They were masons. They were scholars. The Greeks were actually given a choice to join the Spartans against Persia or join Persia against the Spartans. Now, joining Persia, they had hundreds of thousands of men. But if they join Persia, they lose all of their independence. So one of the generals from the Persian army, Xerxes, comes to the Greeks and asks them to join them against the Spartans. And so the Greeks had to make a decision. And so what they did, being one of the first democratic civilizations, is they brought it to a vote. And they had all of their men come to the top of this hill, and they had these white and black rocks. And if they casted a white rock, that was for Sparta. If they casted a black rock, that was for the Persians. And at the end of the vote, the Greeks decide in that vote to join the Spartans because they didn't want to lose their independence. Could you imagine if a character like Donald Trump or Xerxes, and at the end of the vote, he just wasn't satisfied with the results and he contested the results? Because the next move was he had to go to King Leonidas and tell him that the Greeks voted for the Spartans. He didn't want to do that. But they didn't have Twitter or Facebook or any social media, so Xerxes had to go with his tail between his legs, and, well, you can imagine what happened next. Yeah, so tough is the Spartans of 300 and the Greeks of maybe 7,000. Take on hundreds of thousands of Persian soldiers and win. That's tough. Wearing shorts in 40 degrees, that's not tough. It might be bold. It might show resilience, but that's not tough. that's just unnecessarily challenging your immune system. What should a golfer do if his or her shot goes out of bounds in the middle of somebody's backyard? I've talked about this before in previous podcasts, but something came up again last week, and I thought I'd ruminate again. Hitting a drive out of bounds is demoralizing. Something happens in the middle of your swing. You lose focus, you lose confidence. Maybe you're in the wrong spot at the top of your backswing. Maybe you slide your hips on your downswing, or you don't rotate your hips and you block your shot. Or maybe your hands get so far behind you in your backswing that the only way you could come through and hit the ball is to stand up and then you pull hook it. Any of those or some of those are happening during your swing. And then when you make contact with the ball, as soon as you hit it, you know something's wrong. No! So now you've hit your ball and your ball is heading towards the white stakes. And if you've never prayed before, you're now applying the hope is a strategy mindset. And you're thinking, God, no. Oh
my God. No, God! No, God, please, no! No! No!
Or you start talking and yelling at your ball like the sound of your voice is going to, like a well-trained dog, have it stop and turn back.
Go, go,
sit, sit,
go, go.
Be the right club today.
Fight, fight. Come on, baby.
Oh, get a little right, just a little,
just a little.
No, sit, sit.
Are you kidding?
Quit, leave it alone. Leave it alone.
Like, go left, go left. Yeah, why, by the way, why do golfers, after they've hit the ball, and I'm one of them, starts yelling at the ball to do certain things that it wants it to do? Either go further, slow down, go left, go right. It is just our anxiety. And it's funny because when you're playing with somebody else and they see your ball going out of bounds, they're going to try and make you feel better by going, go left, go left. Like their talking to the ball is going to make it any better. Once you hit your ball, here's a clue. It's going to do whatever the club face hitting the ball is going to make it do. Anything that you say from that point on is going to have absolutely no effect on your ball, unless you have one of those listening balls, at which point they do everything that you want. So now your ball looks like it has careened out of bounds, and you don't know where it is yet. And again, you're hoping, you're praying, whatever it is that makes you feel better. And so what do you do now? Well, if you have the fastest cart in the neighborhood, your chances that your ball stayed in are exponentially greater than if you don't. But let's say you don't. Like, don't have the fastest cart. Not don't get caught cheating. So now you have to start the dreaded hunt. Some guys are great at finding lost balls. When I hit a bad shot, a lot of times I just take my eye off it because I just don't want to see the disaster and the mess, which makes it harder to find a lost ball. But other guys are like eagle eye, and they know exactly where their balls went out of bounds. They know how far they hit the ball, and they have a pretty good idea of where that ball is located. Some guys I play with pride themselves after a round when they found more golf balls than they lost. They have a knack for it. They also, more times than not, lose track of time and have to be reminded that, hey, you know, we're on the clock. We got to play in like 15 minutes per hole. One of the worst feelings on a golf course is having the ranger make a beeline to you or your group and ask you to pick up your pace. And I mean, so many guys get defensive and sideways with the ranger when they're told to pick it up. Number one, you paid a lot of money to play. Who are you, the ranger, to tell me what pace I should be playing in? Number two, hey, the cart girl slowed everybody up because she was flirting with us, trying to run up the tab. Sure, wink, wink. Number three, the guys in front of you are really the problem. You're not the problem. Or number four, one of your buddies, or worse possibly, your boss, who invited you and paid for the round of golf, is just stinking up the joint that day, and he is causing the slow play. Seeing a rager heading directly towards you, to me, is like seeing a police car in your rearview mirror. It's just disquieting. So now you or your playing partners have spotted the ball. It's clearly out of bounds in the middle of your neighbor's yard. So now what do? And let's just assume you didn't break your window or hit anybody. Well, I think the first thing you should do is just survey the yard. Are there any people? Are there any dogs? Let's say there are none. You should go as quickly as possible without looking too goofy. Go pick up your ball and walk it back in bounds. If you didn't hit a provisional shot on the tee box once you thought you might have hit it out of bounds, then you walk in bounds, you place it two club lengths from the OB stakes, no closer to the hole, you take a two-stroke penalty and just whack it. And here's some coaching and counsel for somebody new to the sport. Do not, under any circumstances, try and hit your ball from the middle of their yard. The last thing that you want is a chance encounter with the homeowners or their next-door neighbors. I mean, this is going to be worse than a meeting between the Proud Boys and BLM activists. Nothing good comes from that. I mean, imagine how you feel. You've been working all week, and your significant other has been on you all weekend about mowing the lawn and keeping up a nice lawn. And so you mow the lawn, you spend whatever time that is mowing it, and all of a sudden you see this guy in your backyard with this 7-iron just digging up your backyard because he keeps taking divots because he can't hit the golf ball. Imagine that feeling next time that you go see your ball in somebody else's yard. Here's another scenario. Imagine that your ball is close to the imaginary line between the two nearest white stakes. What do you do? What's the best way to handle that? Well, I've seen some guys look at it and say, it's in, and they just hit it because they want it to be in. It's like when you're watching your favorite NFL teams and there's a really close call. In your mind, the call should be going the way it benefits you and your team. That's how you see it. Well, that's how a lot of people see their ball kind of tethering that imaginary line. The best way to handle it is to have someone else in your foursome, preferably not your playing partner, because in 99.9% of the time, the guy who is in the bet with you on your side will probably see it the way you do, in bounds. With one exception, if you're playing with my buddy, Cloudy Graves, he is the most honest man in golf. He's the kind of guy that you could play poker with over the phone and you could trust everything that he said. He'll call it like he sees it. If he thinks it's a little bit out of bounds, he's like, hey, Richie, man, that's out of bounds. Just go throw it in, take your stroke penalty, take your medicine, hit your shot. I mean, don't you wish that more attorneys and politicians were that way? Anyway, I digress. So the best thing I think is to ask the people you're playing against, do you think it's in bounds? Now, most guys don't want to see you fail because of a very close call. And if you kind of see it on the line or in bounds, they'll probably see it the same way, unless, you know, they don't want you to win, and it might be the last hole, and it'll make the difference in them winning or not, then they might be a little more crucial in their judgment. But from the most part, ask them, let them make the decision, and then either hit the shot or pull it in bounds and take your medicine. I was playing the other week with Billy the Kid, and he hits this wayward drive on the 11th hole at Charleston National. It has a very narrow fairway with a lake on the left-hand side that catches just about every hooked ball. And then there are bunkers on the right and houses to the right of that. Billy was right of the bunkers by the houses, and he was walking through some foliage to the right of the OB stakes. I think he had already found his ball. That's just one of his well-tuned skill sets. He was looking to add to his collection. Again, like one of the guys who likes to be net plus in balls found versus loss. So now a lady approaches him and asks him to get off her property. Like she was Yellowstone's John Dutton when anybody trespasses on his ranch. And Billy was cordial, but he was confident. He was confident that he wasn't breaking any HOA bylaws. But she was angry and started excoriating him by spewing her own perception of the community bylaws. And she would say something like, "You are not allowed to enter my property unless invited. And any golf ball that I find on my property is now mine." It's almost like the version of finders, keepers, losers, weepers. But Billy didn't want to do like a Custer's last stand with this lady, and he left the property to hit his ball that he had just spotted feet inside the OB stakes. So now I'm telling this story to my buddy Mike Kay, or he was there with us. I don't remember, but we got into the subject of going on people's property to get balls. And he said that basically she was bending the truth. Now, that's his executive way of saying she was just full of shit. He went as far as to retrieve a copy of the Charleston National bylaws, which illustrated his point. And here's what they say. Each lot or unit adjacent to a golf course, fairway, tee, or green, shall be subject to the right and easement on the part of registered golf course players to enter upon the unimproved portions of such lots to remove a ball, with such entering not being deemed to be a trespass. It goes on to state that golf carts and push carts are not allowed on the property. And it also said that golfers are not to spend an unreasonable amount of time or commit a nuisance thereon. So, basically what it says is, if you paid to play golf, and you're playing and you hit your ball on somebody's yard, then basically you can go and get your ball, just don't be a nuisance and don't spend too much time doing it and don't drive your golf cart on there and certainly don't hit your ball from their yard. So she was either misinformed by telling him he couldn't enter the property, or she had had it with golfers entering her property and she thought she would just say, you know, "This is my property line, you can't come over my property line, I've had it." Now look, there are a lot of golfers that abuse their rights. There are golfers that are going to drive their carts on people's property, hit balls when it's out of bounds because they don't want to lose a bet. And they'll be disrespectful of people's property. And there are probably enough of them over time where homeowners just get sideways and they get tired of it. And then somebody with all good intentions just gets caught up in that. That's probably what happened with her. And I'm fairly certain this was the same lady that when I was rangering like a year ago, pulled me aside and told me about people urinating on her yard and exposing their penises. And I'm like, "Hey, what do you say to that?" I'm like, "Well, they shouldn't have done that. And I think you should report it." And she goes, "I did. I called the general manager. I called the owner. And I guess you shouldn't do that." So here's another thing, other than not hitting your ball in somebody's yard, don't expose yourself to the property owners. They don't like it. Most of them don't like it. Some, at least one. And as for me, and deciding whether my ball is in bounds or out of bounds in that imaginary line, I believe that all lines in our universe are geodesic. There are no straight lines in space. Therefore, there are no straight lines between two white stakes on a golf course. There's always a geodesic curve where my ball rests on the inbound side of that curve. Unless I'm playing with Cloudy Graves and he just says, hey, Richie, that's about as far OB as you can get. Throw out another ball and take your medicine. I'm watching the American Express Championship in Palm Springs, California this past weekend. It used to be the Bob Hope Classic or the Desert Classic or the Bob Hope Desert Classic. Now it has American Express as the sponsor. There was a stat that their insights team posted for just a second after one of the PGA players found the water at the stadium course. Like baseball, the PGA keeps stats on things that, well, don't really matter. You know, it's like betting on junk in golf. It doesn't matter how somebody makes a score. It's the score that determines the winner. So they put this stat up on what the PGA tournament course, which PGA tournament course yielded most balls hit in the water in 2021. Can you guess? Well, if you said Hilton Head, which has water on just about every hole, you'd be wrong. It wasn't even in the top five. Or the TPC Sawgrass, which has water on most holes and then has that 17th Island Green, you'd be wrong. If you said the PGA National Course in Palm Beach or at the American Express Championship, the West Stadium Course, you'd be wrong. It's the TPC Twin Cities. Now, not a very popular tournament, probably because it comes right before or right after a major. But the TPC Twin Cities, last year in their tournament, saw 317 balls go in the water. That is a lot of balls. By the way, Sawgrass was second at 288. That's 26 dozen balls dumped into watery graves. That's close to a week's worth of shots in the water at the par 3 seventh hole at Charleston National. And if not for a few alligators that live on that hole, a bunch of my buddies would be snorkeling every weekend just to add to their collection of more balls found than they lost themselves. Can meetings outside the office make business better? Can business golf make business better? I've talked about this in one of my first and also top five viewed episodes, how not to fuck it up when you're playing business golf. I tell some personal stories about how golf can help or screw up a business deal depending on how you approach it. Someone in my past once told me that the business of people takes place after 5 p.m. Everything up until that point is just posturing. You learn a lot about people over drinks, almost as much about learning about people on a golf course. Alcohol is an elixir that, over time, reduces inhibitions and reveals someone's true self, which could be good or bad depending on what that true self is. Golf does something similar. Peter Jacobson, ex-PGA player and current golf commentator, once said, "You're never as naked as you are when you're on a golf course, particularly when you start to make mistakes." How you play with others reveals your attention to rules, etiquette, and respect for others. The game might be presented as a bet, but it's really a test of your courage, ability to control yourself, and respect those around you who are trying to do the same. Everybody wants to do their best and win. That doesn't always happen. Being invited back to play again is the true test. It's either that or you're just such a rube that you're everybody's free lunch. Some meetings happen better in an informal environment, like a golf course, or like Cabo San Lucas. I was watching SportsCenter the other day and was fascinated about how Sean McVay, coach of the LA Rams, made the multiplayer deal for Matthew Stafford. And the story loosely goes like this. Matthew Stafford, postseason, was vacationing with his family in Cabo San Lucas. Now, he was either there with a friend who used to play with in college who's now playing for the Rams, or he happened to run into him. His friend mentions that Coach McVay was also in Cabo vacationing and that they should meet. He thought they had a lot in common. So over drinks, Stafford's now having drinks with McVay, and a few drinks in, Stafford recalls this game-winning drive from years earlier. McVay also remembers every detail of that game-winning drive. I mean, it revealed that the two of them have a similar passion for details and football.
Let's play a game, all right? On the count of three, name your favorite dinosaur. Don't even think about it. Just name it. Ready? One, two, three. Velociraptor.
Favorite non-pornographic magazine to masturbate to.
Good Housekeeping.
If you were a chick, who's the one guy you would sleep with?
John Stamos. What?
Did we just become best friends?
Yep.
Hours later, the coach, with the support of his GM, put together a multiplayer trade to get Stafford on the Rams. And as you can see from this weekend, with the Rams going to the championship game, it was a good bet. Just like in golf, sometimes a different setting creates a better environment than the office to get things done. If you ever get a chance to play golf with a potential customer, vendor, employee, or boss, remember the objective is not a zero-sum game, which is I win, you lose. It's about getting on the same page and liking the company of the other person. Look for a win-win. And talking about win-wins, if anybody had the time to sit down and watch any of the four games this weekend, which sent teams into the AFC and NFC championship, it was time well spent. These were probably the best playoff games I've ever seen in a weekend. Each game comes down to either a field goal or seconds on the clock to have to make something happen or you're going to lose, with unbelievable comebacks. Tom Brady made another comeback, just like he did when he played against Atlanta. I mean, they were down 27-3, I think, and he comes back to tie it up. Unfortunately, Stafford, with seconds on the clock, takes his team down, makes a field goal, wins the game. And the same thing, similar situation, happened in the Buffalo-Kansas City game. I mean, it was back and forth with probably two of the best quarterbacks on the field that could just do incredible things. And with just seconds on the clock, I think most people believe that Buffalo won the game. Most people, except for Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs. It is incredible when you see some of these quarterbacks walk on the field and they're calm as can be, because they know what they're capable of. Just like coming down to the 18th hole and you have to birdie it to win or go into a playoff. Most people can't do it, but the greats seem to do it time after time. You've been listening to another episode from Tales from the First Tee. I'm your host, Rich Easton, telling tales from beautiful Charleston, South Carolina. Talk to you soon.